Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we got a really cool player over from the UK with us today. We're with Adam Goldsmith. He's also funny as hell, and I hope we'll get to laugh here. After graduating, some background on him from the Royal Academy of Music, his first big gig was with Pop Idol TV show and arena tour. That was like the forerunner of American Idol television. Before that, he was doing jazz and club dates around London. He then went on to do quite a lot of TV from the first 3 years of The Voice in-house band, which was, part of the house band of The Voice, to sessions for American Idol, Britain's Got Talent, and many other TV shows, including Doctor Who and Downton Abbey. Did you watch Doctor Who as a kid?
No.
You did not? What the hell? Isn't that like sacrilege? I thought everybody had to watch that growing up.
Yeah, I know. Everyone except me. And yeah. I know loads of people are really big fans of it. And they're like, oh, what's happening in this series? I've got no idea.
Even my wife watched it. And she's like not even into that. But she knew. She bought all these videos for our kids when they were younger, thinking they were going to watch it. They didn't. But anyway, his film credits, man, you got some impressive film credits here. Bridget Jones, Baby, Paddington 2, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Les Miserables, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Did you see that movie?
No, I've not seen it yet. I want to watch it.
It was pretty good, man. It was
I just want to make a point. Everyone always asks me about that. Is the solo Spanish guitar stuff me? It's not.
It was a great soundtrack.
Rhythm guitar and mandolin, I think, on that.
Very cool soundtrack. Great movie, man.
So I've heard.
Pete's Dragon, The Hobbit, Battle of the Five Armies, Hoodwink 2, Mary Poppins Returns, Sherlock Gnomes, and the forthcoming Judy Garland biopic called Judy, starring Renee Zellweger. His live work includes the European leg of Gloria Estefan Standards Tour, a promo tour for Seal last year in Europe, and he also worked with all the major orchestras in the UK, including the London Symphony and the Royal Philharmonic. Adam, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, God, do your kids love you that you do all these kids soundtracks?
They're a bit young.
Oh, to be honest.
They're 6 and 3. So No,
the awareness is not there yet. Yeah.
No.
What made you pick like Royal Academy of Music, which I think you were just talking about with me, over other music schools in England?
I don't remember, to be honest. I think it was the fact that it said Royal. It sounded impressive. It almost sounds like you're doing some like a real subject. You do a tour or something. Where did you go? It's the Royal Academy of Music. Sounds like you might know what you're doing.
That's an epic reason, man. That is great.
I don't remember, to be honest. I mean, it was, you know, sort of 23, 24, however many years ago or so. Yeah, I don't really remember. I think they had a new course starting out. Oh, that was what it was. Yeah, I do remember. Their new head of jazz was a guy called Gerard Presenza, who you may or may not have heard of, possibly. He's a ridiculous jazz trumpeter. I mean, he's one of the best in the world. And he was the new head of jazz. And at the time, I was in his band.
Oh, cool.
And I didn't really know what I was doing. I wasn't working as much as I thought I was going to be straight away, you know, when you're sort of 19, 20 or whatever. I remember I did a couple of days recording on Gerard's album, and I said to Gerard, well, you know, what's this course like? I think there's still some stuff that I might like to learn, you know, well, a lot of things that I'd like to learn. And he said, well, why don't you audition for it? And so I did audition for it, and he let me in because I was in his band.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So that was the reason, actually.
Was that like a 1 year or 2 year program? What was that?
The academy. I actually did before that. I did a classical degree at a place called Birmingham Conservatoire.
Oh wow!
Yes, yeah. And then
in Birmingham.
Yeah, in Birmingham.
Okay.
Birmingham,
yeah. That's where that's where Sabbath is from, isn't it?
Yeah.
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 Is that like that's a very industrial town?
Yeah, it used to be. I just went drinking, so I don't know. I didn't have
any questions. It was hard. You didn't notice.
Experience of the factories of Birmingham when I was there. So that was 3 years, and that was classical music. And then I did the jazz postgrad at the Royal Academy.
Wow. That's really impressive. That's a lot of work, man. Good for you.
Sounds impressive.
It does sound impressive. Yeah. Hey, man. That's very cool. So how did you wind up getting involved doing movie soundtracks? And do you, in addition to playing, do you also write any scores or underscores?
The only writing I've done is... do you know what library music means? Does that translate?
Yeah, library music?
Production music. I don't know whether that library music, do you call it that?
Well, it's, I mean, if, go ahead.
It's sort of where you write music to a certain brief and you sell it to a company who then sell it to whoever wants to buy it.
It's licensing, music licensing.
Yeah, licensing. So I've done a bit of that. I haven't written for any movies or anything like that specifically. Like, I always wanted to be a player first. I wasn't really so interested in writing.
How did you get hooked up doing movies? Because you've done a ton of them, and you've done some big name movies.
Yeah. Well, there's a lady that runs, she's a fixer. You guys call them contractors, I think.
Go ahead.
And her name is Isabel Griffiths. And basically, she organizes musicians. She's based in London for a lot of the big films. I think a good degree of them get recorded over here. A good degree of the Hollywood films, you know, the American productions, a good proportion of them get recorded in London.
I was surprised at that, how many American, like that, yeah. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, that's as an American movie as you can get. I think it takes place in the Midwest.
Yeah.
It's very American.
Yeah, I mean, and I, you know, a lot of the strings at least are done over here. I mean, I think probably most people would be surprised at the amount which done over there. I think that's for several reasons. We've, you know, got a good tradition of studio musicians over here, as you guys have over there as well. So it's certainly nothing to do with, is anyone better? You know, I mean, we've got some great guys. You've got, obviously, you know, everyone knows about the studio scene in LA and everything. But I'm ready to be wrong on this, but you guys have better unions than us. So you get better residuals.
Yes, so, probably.
Especially for TV and stuff. I know a friend of mine played drums on an American Idol series. He's an English guy. His wife is from LA. And he also played drums on the equivalent over here at the time, which was owned by the same people as Britain's Got Talent. And he said, you know, he made sort of three or four times the amount of money.
Wow, on royalties.
Yeah, so...
they have a pool here. Right. From what I understand, they have it's like a big pot of money that says something like, well, you know, you got paid X dollars to do this gig, but if this movie went on to make $500 million, it's not fair that... that's all you make. So it's like this pool that they allow the musicians and everybody who participated to share in. Okay, I think that's what you're. Yeah.
We don't get that. Yeah. You don't get that. You get, without going to really boring details, you don't get that you've just described. You get, if you played on a record and it gets played on the radio, you get a very small fee every so often.
Yeah.
You know, but you don't get what you just described in the way of residuals. So right. I think possibly from an accounting point of view, it's easier for the people who make the movie to budget for us.
Wow.
I think it's that.
Yeah.
I'm ready to be wrong, but it does happen a lot. And also, I think you guys like coming over to Abbey Road and staying at the Savoy for a couple of weeks, drinking and doing whatever the hell it is. Taking over a floor in the Savoy and, you know, doing whatever.
Well, I didn't realize I interviewed – do you know who Lyle Workman is?
Yeah.
I interviewed Lyle a couple of weeks ago, and you know, he wrote like one of my favorite soundtracks ever, Superbad. And I asked him, I said, why would they hire you to write that as opposed to, like, for example, pulling instrumental music from the, you know, funk music, James Brown era from the 60s, you know? And he said, I didn't know this, but it cost to license one song for a major movie. It's cost between $300,000 and $400,000.
Well, there you go.
I was like, fuck, man, that's amazing. I mean,
it's really expensive.
That's crazy. Yeah. So, yeah. So basically, they do a lot of movies over there to save a couple of bucks, is what
I think that might be it. Great. Yeah.
Yeah. What are the challenges of doing movies as opposed to, say, touring or studio work? Studio work on non-movie productions.
Well, it's not dissimilar, I don't think, apart from the fact that, in terms of studio work, like, say, if you're recording on somebody's record, then it's pretty obvious that it's a song, and you can sort of hear the ups and downs, you can hear it as a piece. Whereas movies can be a bit weird because you might record a 30-second cue, and they're called obscure things like 1M38, which, the place in the movie, a physical time in the movie.
Sure.
And it might be something that doesn't make a huge amount of sense on its own without the visuals.
Yeah, okay.
So you can't, like with a song, you can probably say, oh, why don't we try this here? Because we're going to the chorus and I'm going to like step on some more distortion or whatever, and I'll bring the energy up or something like that. But with movies, you don't know what's happening necessarily when you're recording it. So,
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So unless you're told, someone might tell you, I remember with one of the Bridget Jones ones, or anyway, Colin Firth was kissing somebody. I can't remember what film it was. I think Bridget Jones. And there was like a delicate guitar bit, like a classical guitar bit. And I could see they had next to the Pro Tools screen, they had the movie happening at the same time.
Okay.
And I could see what I was recording to. So you get an idea there that it's like romantic guitar. But generally, you've got less of an idea where the music's fitting in.
Interesting. Yeah. That makes it harder to put like the emotional, the soul, basically, into it at times, I would imagine.
I guess so, yeah. So, a lot of the time the music speaks for itself, and it just – so if it's really obviously like a romantic thing, then you just go for it. I mean, the last film I did, I don't know if you guys – I don't know how much cross-pollination is. I don't know how many British films you get, but this was a British film about – we had a robbery over here in a place called Hatton Garden, which is it's the Diamond Center. And the film's called King of Thieves.
You know what? We get – I don't know if it's – I watch a lot of British stuff because of my wife.
Yeah, sure.
Because her mom's always saying, hey, there's this series on. And you guys have great TV there. Your TV there is far superior to ours. I don't watch any. I say I think because I don't watch TV ever here, ever. Like, yeah. I watch movies once in a while, but that your series are much more well written, and I think so.
But you guys have The Sopranos and The Wire and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, right. And there's some good stuff here, but I think it's like the genre you're talking about. Like, this was robbed and mystery murder shit. That's seems to be a lot your forte or this. So it's called King of Thieves. Sorry.
King of Thieves. Yeah. It's pretty big. It's got Michael Caine in it and Ray Winstone. And, it is what it is. A heist movie. Basically. It's like, it's not dissimilar to Ocean's 11, but it's less glamorous because it's British old men.
He's great. Michael Caine. He's got to be like in his mid 80s, man.
It was pretty cool hearing my guitar playing as Michael Caine was acting.
That is awesome.
I went to the Carson crew. But anyway, my point of that for guitar, talking about guitar playing, is that you sort of knew what it was because it was like 60s. Not dissimilar to the Ocean's 11 style, sort of funky, groovy, suspense kind of.
Acid jazz in the 60s sort of.
That era of stuff. You want to play wah-wah on a lot of things.
That's cool.
So sort of, you do know. When you play stuff like that, you've got a vibe. Like, I use my old 60s 335 and like a Fender and like some old effects and like fuzz boxes and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So you know the vibe when something like that.
Cool. It's funny. There's certain things between the UK and the States. Like, we speak the same language, but there's so many different ways. Like, for example, you guys always say 335.
Say 335.
Correct. Yeah. And it's so... And I'm aware of it more because I, again, because of my wife being from there.
Your wife.
And it's just, there's certain things, like you guys would say, I was talking to someone one time, they said, oh, I had a reading notebook. And I'm like, oh, like we would just say a notebook. Or they said a reading or a writing, something like little, what did my wife, last night my wife said, oh, I was talking on the phone. She goes, "Mom told me she shattered." She goes, "That was so funny." I was like, "Why?" She goes, "I've never heard her say that." And I was like, "Oh, okay." It's just goofy stuff, but it's like, yeah, we have the same language, but we don't have necessarily all the same communication, like, little expressions, sort of, you know?
It's quite funny. I toured in America about 10 years ago, and I found myself turning to a cross between, like being Jewish as well, I turned into a cross between Larry David and Hugh Grant. Like a stupid, only not as funny. You turn into a fucking idiot because you're sort of bumbling around. Like, "Hello, can I have a bottle of water, please?" You know, and what's water? You have to say water. You know? "Oh, right. Now I get what you're talking about." You know, like bumbling around being an idiot for a few weeks.
It's depending upon where you are, too. Like, if you're in the major cities, it's not unusual to hear someone with an accent, right? But if you're in Topeka, Kansas, well, maybe not Kansas, a big place, but if you're in the Midwest, perhaps, where there's, or smaller towns in the South, you know, it's like when I went to Dunstable the first time in like 93. I mean,
you mean Luton, as in England?
Yeah, I was in Dunstable in 93, not even Luton, Dunstable. And I went to an electronics store. My mother-in-law needed a plug or something, and I was dying to get out of the house. And I said, "Let me go." And I went in, and this young girl was there, was like, "Oh my God, I love your accent," which is hysterical because she's never heard him. She's in Dunstable in the 90s. You know, how many Americans are walking around in Dunstable?
Yeah.
You know, not a lot.
That's before the internet, isn't it? Which has obviously changed the entire universe.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
I think we're actually picking up your little isms.
Really?
Yeah, I think we're gradually getting it because of the internet. Like I've heard things like you guys say, if you had a lot of something, if you had a few guitars, you'd say, "We had a bunch of guitars."
Yeah.
And we'd never say that until recently. I've noticed people saying it.
What would you guys say?
"I've got a few guitars."
Okay.
Just little things like that. You know.
Yeah,
it's not very interesting thing to say in an interview, is it? Like,
no, I know, but it is interesting. You know, I mean, I'm interested in it. Sorry, guys. I hope you guys listen.
No, it's me.
No, it's me. What is the most important skill set you need to do movie scores? And is that that might be different from like other work?
Well, I think like the real thing that springs to mind, apart from your musicality, you obviously have to sort of summon some sort of musicality. You've got to be able to concentrate. You've really got to concentrate because I think a friend of mine is an engineer at Air Studios. His name's Jake. He's a great engineer. He told me that on average, people are spending £100 a minute to record a movie score if they've got a band in, like a medium-sized orchestra or whatever, plus the studio itself. It's costing £100 a minute, basically, which is obviously a lot of money.
Yeah, so that's $6,000 in an hour, yeah.
Yeah, which is everything. You know, like that's the musicians and the engineers and whatever. So that's what people are spending, a lot of money. So, you can't fuck it up. That's it. I mean, you can, everyone makes mistakes.
Sure.
So say, "Look, I was a bit out in bar measure 36 or whatever, you know, to do that again." You know, little mistakes here and there, everyone makes those, that's fine. But generally you have to be able to concentrate, especially when you're sitting with string players because they're so quick. If you're in an orchestra, they can sight read anything.
Yeah.
You know, and so you can't be going, "Oh, hang on a minute, I've got to work out my position." You've got to do stuff quickly, you know. So that's a really big part of it, but you have to be able to then translate that quickness into sounding great. So you have to, you know, bring, say if it's a little moment on classical guitar or something, you have to bring that emotion and whatever you're supposed to be putting across quickly. You have to be able to do it on demand,
you know? Is that where I would imagine that's where a lot of your education helped you out with the sight reading, where you have a leg up over a lot of other guys?
Maybe. I think actually where that comes from is that I started classical piano when I was 7. My mum was a classical pianist, and she taught me how to read music.
I don't know. That's great.
Yeah, that's where the reading came from, because then I didn't, when I started reading music for guitar, I didn't have to start from like the very bottom because I knew what a quarter note or a half note, you know, and I knew where the notes were on the stave, and that was already there. And it was, you know, when you learn something when you're that age.
Yeah, it sticks with you forever.
It's in. It goes in. Just take it for granted. It's almost like breathing, you know.
Yeah.
still had to work on it. I had to do a lot of work on being able to sight read, but it was possibly a touch easier than someone who just started when they was like 19 or 20 or something like that.
Oh, that's great, man. I didn't know your mom was a professional piano player.
No, she wasn't a professional. She was just quite good.
That's great, she, man.
Like a housewife. You know, she didn't work.
Talk about for each couple of artists or a couple of your gigs. I'm just curious how you got the gig, and is there you have any cool or interesting stories about your experience working in the situation with Seal? That must have been interesting.
Yeah, see, it was great. It was really good. I mean, it was only a few dates actually. It was a promo tour. It wasn't the full tour. So we did maybe 3 gigs in London, 3 or 4 gigs in London, and we did 2 in Paris. And 1 or 2 somewhere else. So it wasn't a full tour, but it was fun. And we did.
You know how cool that sounds to like most people? Like in the States, you did 3 in London and 2 in Paris. You know, right? Someone in the States is doing 1 in Pensacola in the panhandle of Florida and then going to, you know, Mobile, Alabama. You know, London and Paris are pretty glamorous places. Yeah.
Well, it's really easy for us to get to Paris.
Yeah.
It was actually. I think I was depping for the same person that I did on the Gloria Estefan ones, because sometimes it's cheaper to get, because it was Gloria Estefan's guitar player on the album that I toured was Dean Parks.
Oh, okay.
And I think, if my memory serves me correctly, it was also he also played on the Seal album. So I did the little bits of those when he didn't come over here, you know, for whatever reason.
I have to get him on my show because this is the third time someone's mentioned him to me in a week. Wow. So that's the universe talking to me here, man. So I got to.
He's a legend, isn't he? He's the real thing. You know, back when there was actually a music industry, he was.
Yeah.
You know, so that's.
So you subbed for Dean Parks. That's pretty impressive, man.
Yeah. It is. Well, I mean, he didn't book me. He doesn't know.
No, I know. But I mean, you know, they're not putting in you got a standard of here. They're going to bring in someone who can meet that standard. They're not going backwards.
But my point being is that getting from London, if you live in London, getting to Paris is so easy. Yeah. So you get on a train.
Yeah.
You're a star. Yeah.
A couple of hours or something like that?
Something like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's easy. Easy.
So how did you get that connection?
Seal. I work for a guy. It's a bit roundabout. Cool. I've done a lot of work for him over the past 10 years or so, called Steve Sidwell, who's a very successful sort of musical director, and we're mates as well. He's a really good guy. He got me involved. It was his brother, Richard, who was, he conducted the orchestra on a couple of, like the string orchestra for a couple of Seal's dates here. And Richard got me in. So I came in through Steve.
Any, wild stories or interesting stories working with him? Something must be going on. You keep smiling there. You're trying to figure out if you could, how much disclosure you can say.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's just not specifically involving him.
Sure.
To be honest. Yeah. And I couldn't, you know, even if it was.
Oh yeah. I'm not looking for gossip. No, I'm not. Yeah. Just looking for some fun, funny.
He was super pro. He was really nice to us. But we didn't really hang out, you know, a lot. He sort of came in and out. But, you know, I mean, it's guys away for the evening. So just the usual.
I get it. Yeah.
Nothing particularly, you know. I mean, to be honest, we're all a little bit older. If you ask me about tours that I did when I was like in my early 20s, I might give you some better.
All right. Story. So talk about a funny or interesting story from back then.
God, yeah, funny or interesting.
And who is it with? Who are you touring with?
You know, I can't think of one off the top of my head, so I might have to email you something and you can insert it. Oh, no, you can't do that.
You can't open up that can of worms and then close it. That's not good.
I think it's just, to be honest, it's all, you know, all that sort of touring stories and things like that. I think you can read Slash's autobiography if you want, like, and then I took some drugs and passed out and almost killed myself. You know, like, I've done all that sort of, well, not to the extent that Slash did it. Yeah. Like, we've all done that kind of stuff, you know. There isn't anything beyond the usual.
Just the usual hijinks.
Yeah, just the usual
being hijinks. A guy.
Bullshit. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And to be honest, you know, like, this is going to sound pretty dull, but like I'm almost 42 and I've got two little kids. So if I go away for the night, I really like the fact that I don't have to get up at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, stay in bed, you know.
Yeah, like, so I hear you.
It's a lot calmer than it used to be. And like when I went away with Seal, Paris is such a great city. We went to some lovely restaurants and the record company looked after us really well.
Right.
And we just had a really nice time, drunk some lovely wine, had some great food and looked around Paris. And that was it, I'm afraid. There's no,
like a bunch of old ladies.
yeah, exactly. Like taking photos outside a cathedral.
No, I hear you.
And you know, the real shame of it is if there's any stories which are really that interesting, I can't tell you.
I get it. And I'm not looking for that. I'm not interested in that stuff. Yes, man. I totally get that. Are you working on anything now that you're excited about?
Am I working on anything now that I'm excited about? What am I doing right now? Just a bunch of different sessions and things, I think. I just like working in the studio. I've been in the studio for the past couple of weeks. It's not a big rock and roll project by any stretch of the imagination. It's like an online resource for the Royal Schools of Music, where it's like a music minus one thing. So it isn't a big rock and roll thing at all. But I've been in the studio constantly, working really hard, playing a million different styles every day, using all my different guitars and reading and concentrating, you know. So I've really enjoyed that. That's been the past 2 or 3 weeks been doing that.
Yeah, but that's a great gig. I mean, I don't think there isn't a lot of big rock and roll things anymore. No. I mean, that's just the way it is. But that's a great gig for you because, A, you're probably getting paid well. B, you're getting treated well because they respect you as a musician. You went to the school, right? So, I mean, you know, they pay on time, you know, so I mean, that's a great gig. Yeah. You probably have a ton of autonomy as far as they're not going to be up your ass to do this and that because they respect you and they understand that you know what to do. That's a great gig, man.
It's a really great gig. I've really enjoyed it. So it's, and also, you know, as a guitar player, I love old guitars and effects and all this sort of stuff, loads of us do. So I get to sit in a studio for 2 weeks surrounded by all the stuff that I've, you know, bought and geeked out on over and get to play it. You know, I love, and you get to justify spending loads of money on vintage guitars to your wife.
That's always a plus.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's like I interviewed, do you know Jerry McPherson?
No, I don't.
He's a top session guy in Nashville. He's been around for 35 years. Very lovely guy. And when I asked him, I said the similar question, he said, yeah, I'm working on stuff for Facebook now. I'm like, oh, what are you doing? And he said, you know, all the music they have that you can add to photos, and they just have tons of licensing kind of things there. So he's just providing all the music stuff for them. And he said, it's a great job. They pay well, they pay on time. There's a ton of work. They leave you alone. So it's it's a great gig, man.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I haven't got one project on. I'm lucky. I'm at the moment. I've got a lot of sessions on. I've got, I've got some gigs in 2 weeks with, do you guys know Beverly Knight?
I know the name.
I mean, she's big over here. She's like a soul singer. I mean, she's amazing. She's completely brilliant. I think a couple of albums ago, she actually recorded it in Nashville using a lot of the old guys from, where it kind of sounds a bit like the Meters sounded, you know what I mean? Like those kind of sounds they were using. I don't know who was in the band, but it's like, you know, that a lot of old guys from Nashville she used, you know. But I've got some gigs with her coming up, which I'm really looking forward to. Just little bits dotted here. And, you know, I'm doing an album for the one of the guys from Aladdin, the Broadway show.
Cool.
You know, doing that on the weekend, this weekend. I'm not sure who he plays. I think he's one of the leads. I don't know who. I have not seen the show. So lots of stuff dotted around, basically. And I also I'm in the orchestra for one of the West End shows at the moment, like a Broadway show.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's my...
So you're in the pit. Is it called the pit there?
It's called a pit.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's why I asked. Yeah, it's the pit.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of good stuff on. It's all first quality.
Really lucky.
Yeah.
I'm really lucky, yeah.
That's great, man. Where'd you grow up in the UK?
About half an hour outside of London.
What?
No one's going to have heard of it. It's in between the nearest big town was a place called Reading.
Okay.
I went to school in a place called Henley-on-Thames.
You have some cool names there. It's always
Henley. Yeah, I suppose, Thames.
That sounds so posh, man.
Henley is posh. I'm not posh, but Henley is posh.
Yeah, Henley-on-Thames. That's T-H-A-M-E-S, right?
That's like the river.
Yeah, anything, even the spelling is posh, man. I'm from the Bronx. I mean, it just doesn't sound posh, you know?
That's much cooler.
I don't know. If you survive, it's much cooler. So it was a small town then? Like, was it rural?
Reading's not, I mean, it's almost a city, you know, but I mean, we're to half an hour drive from London.
Okay.
You know, so, it's not, it wasn't like it was the middle of nowhere, but Henley's a small town, but it's right on the outskirts of London. You know,
what was your childhood like growing up?
I was pretty regular. I mean, I got obsessed with music pretty quickly, actually. My parents got divorced when I was about seven. So that was the only bump in the road, really. Apart from that, it was pretty regular. My dad taught me a couple of guitars. He didn't do it for a living, but he taught me a couple of guitar chords when I was about 12, 13. And straight away, I didn't really get into piano that much. I played it for about 5 years, but I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And then he showed me a couple of chords. I can remember. I remember the evening, clear as day. He was like, check these chords out. I was 12, I think. And I was like, this is fucking cool.
Yeah. You know what
I
mean?
And I remember he had this bass guitar stack. It was by a company called H&H. I don't even know if they're still around. It was like a big stack bass guitar amplifier. And it had a button on it that said distortion. Right. And he used to play his electric guitar through it. And I didn't even know what distortion was, but I'd started listening to Queen and things like that. And I pressed this button and I was like, that's the sound. It was obviously shit as well. It was a bass amp and it was like transistor. It would probably sounded terrible. I was like, that, I don't know what that is, but that is fucking brilliant. And that's the noise I want to make forever.
That's so cool.
But my childhood wasn't particularly remarkable. I just got taken over by music quite quickly, and I never wanted to do anything else. I never had any interest, you know. I ignored a lot of the lessons at school.
The academic stuff?
I didn't care. I just didn't care really quickly. I liked English, which I'm glad I liked it, because I write a monthly column in Guitarist magazine.
Tell you, I've seen it in the stores. That is a fucking beautiful thick. And they charge you an arm and a leg for it. So it's like £100 to subscribe. And I'm like, what? No one's fucking paying that over here. I don't know how people might. Yeah, it's a ton of money. It's a beautiful magazine, but I always want. And the company that makes that, they have they have like photography magazines.
Future Publishing. Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. I just never understand how people, again, here, the cost of a magazine, I don't know, maybe it's $30, $50 a year or something for a top end.
Not right. Oh no.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's super.
I actually bought a copy of it the other day. I've been on at them to give me a free subscription, seeing as I've been writing for them for about 3 years. But they
you charge £100? Hey, listen. I hope you guys are listening. How can you charge £100 for a subscription and not give the guy a free subscription? Subscription fees,
Jamie,
a writer.
If you're listening,
come on, man.
To your house.
hook a brother up. This is crazy, man.
I've been asking for ages. No, it's not happening. But all joking aside, my editor, Jamie Dixon, he's a lovely, lovely guy. And I really enjoy that column. I don't do it for the money, obviously. I just do it because, I'll tell you why I do it. It's because when I was growing up, you know, Tommy Tedesco, you must have.
Sure, yeah, from the Wrecking Crew. In LA.
Yeah, yeah. So he had a column which described sessions.
Oh, so is that what you do?
Yeah, it's called. Well, I'm not comparing myself to Tommy.
No. But I mean, do you write
same
a similar?
Yeah,
that's great, man.
A column called Session Diary, and I just write it, you know, like a one or two pages, and that's why I wanted to do it, because it was magical to me from a really young age, like the idea of being a session musician.
So you wanted to be a session guy from a young age?
Yeah. Yeah, I never wanted to be in a band. Yeah. Man,
so you're living your dream.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, not many people get to do that.
Yeah, yeah. It was either that or like being Megadeth. I was really into thrash metal. like 80s Bay Area thrash metal was my thing. It was either one of the two, but you know.
That's funny. I interviewed Alex from Testament. You know Alex?
Did you? Yeah, I love Alex that guy. Yeah, he's got his jazz thing going on. Great. Yeah, he was a hero of mine when I was a kid. Yeah.
And he's a great, his jazz, I'm not into thrash metal, but his jazz trio is awesome. And,
you know, I know Testament pretty well. I've never heard his jazz playing though.
Yeah. I'm just writing it down. I'll send you a copy of the interview later on.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, he's a pretty deep guy. It's a pretty good interview.
He was a great player. I remember him playing his Ibanez, and like he had such a lovely fluid technique. I remember checking him out. And I also loved Eric Peterson from Testament as well. Great, the big, huge rhythm player, you know. They were a great band.
Yeah, when a guy like that, it's amazing. Like when I watch him play, it's like almost like a switch is flipped and all of a sudden is in turbo. And I don't even know how the hell he's doing. It's like beyond. I mean, it's just magic. I don't know what the hell he's doing it to play so clean at that speed. It's just phenomenal, man.
It's really brilliant. Really brilliant. Yeah. I'd be really interested to hear his jazz play for that reason, actually.
I'll send you a video. There's a video on YouTube called Train Man that he did with a woman, part of her trio, Jane Getter Trio, another lady I interviewed. It's great. I'll send you that link. It's phenomenal. Really good. So that's cool. So you're writing for guitar. Is that online, your column also?
You can download the magazine. Yeah, you can buy it.
And it's called Guitarist Magazine, and it's Sessions Diary.
Session Diary, yeah.
Awesome, man. Everybody check that out.
That's just a bit of a labor of love. It doesn't take me long, to be honest. It's just like a couple of hours a month, you know. That's it. I'm just writing.
No, man, No. Let's change. You slave away over that thing, and all you're looking for is a subscription.
That's the one. See, that's why
I'm the marketing guy.
You're the marketing guy. Yeah.
Got a positioning, man. It's positioning.
Surrounded
dude.
By coffee cups and guitars. Yeah, I need to get it together.
What kind of work did your folks do? You say your mom was a stay-at-home mom?
Yeah, she's a stay-at-home mom. My dad was in finance. To be honest, to this day, I couldn't tell you what he does. He sort of, I think the financial services for accountancy, like buys and sells accountancy companies or some shit. I don't know, to be honest.
He's an international man of mystery.
He is a spy. He does. Yeah.
Awesome, man.
Something to do with finance. Yeah.
Do you have any other side hustles, like besides playing guitar, that are, you know, music related, but not necessarily picking up or not picking up the guitar in a conventional? I mean, you're doing a bunch of things. You do teaching, you do sessions, you do touring. So I guess that's a bunch of side hustles right there. And you do
enough
movies.
Is the short answer to your question. Yeah. Right. No. I like Stephen Fry's quote about his job, in as much as I feel like music's my area of least incompetence. So that's nothing.
That's awesome, man. I've never heard that. That is brilliant.
Great quote, isn't it? Yeah.
But, it's my area of least incompetence. I love that.
I know I don't have any side hustles, to be honest. Yeah. I could make something up. I'm on the weekends, my name is Amanda. And roam the streets of Soho.
I don't judge. If it's consensual, it doesn't bother me. Yeah. What were some of the lower points, or maybe some of the obstacles that you've had to deal with over your career, and how did you get through them? Either music, business, personal.
The only real one I think is when in my very early 20s, like when I just left college, as a period, because the music, you know, let's face it, it's not the 70s. So you don't walk into doing, I'm reading Steve Lukather's biography at the moment, autobiography, sorry.
Yeah.
It's hilarious, completely brilliant. I'd recommend it to anyone that hasn't read it. But he talks about going doing these huge sessions from when he's like 20, 21. And I think that was indicative of the time, you know, because it just, you know, I guess I'm talking about, mid to late 90s when I was that sort of age, I guess. And it just wasn't like that. It wasn't the same thing. So I went through a period of going, I mean, you're sort of doing functions and a bit of teaching and that kind of stuff, you know, trying to get started.
Yeah.
Because there are sessions, but there aren't enough for you to be doing them because there's already guys doing them. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So there was a period when I was going, you know, I don't appear to be doing what I wanted to do, you know. And it didn't last very long. Looking back, it was probably only a year or so. It just felt like a long time.
Yeah, but a year is a long time when you're hustling for money and it's not coming in. That fucking year feels like a year every day, man.
Yeah, yeah. So that, I mean, it wasn't really about money then either, to be honest, because you don't have any particular bills when you're that age. You know, stuff isn't as expensive as it is now. No, house prices were pretty normal, you know, like, so the rent wasn't ridiculous.
No, but it's a more of a function of, you know, I think we tend to often measure our self-worth at a younger age, especially with, you know, into your, you tie success as a measure, or how much you're making as a measure of your self-worth. And when you get older, you realize, man, there's a lot more to life than this. And, you know, you're just focused on happiness, period, you know, but it's, it's not necessarily, even financially, it's not tough. Emotionally, it's not, it's like,
it's really tough. So that's the lowest point. I mean, and it wasn't even, you know, it's not a low point in terms of, you know, I don't live in a famine area in some, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like a first world problem, really, you know,
sure.
Not gambling enough sessions, you know, but like, but it's certainly, I remember not feeling, because I think you're becoming an adult, really, because at university you're still fucking about, aren't you?
Yeah.
Or college, you guys call it college, don't you? But like, you're still fucking about, and you've got a structure, you've got an imposed structure on your life. So you can go, oh, it just doesn't matter if I haven't got any gigs. I've got, you know, a harmony lesson in the morning, and I've got my mates here. I'm going to go to the pub and I'm going to have a few beers, and I'll get up and we'll laugh about it, and everything's fine. Don't have to worry. So, and then all of a sudden, I mean, it's not like you work for a bank where there's a structure.
Right. You're self-employed, man. It's, you know.
So you go.
You're an entrepreneur, college, essentially.
So you're on your own. You leave college and then you go, right, I'm a professional musician. Except you're not. You're just an unemployed bloke.
Yeah.
For quite a bit, you know.
That's hard to rationalize.
Yeah. And I found it. Some people find it less hard. I found it quite hard, you know. That's probably the lowest point. And it's not particularly a low point, more of a lesson than anything. And you just have to realize, I think it takes a while to work up the, not just the musical skill set, but your social network in the older sense of the word, as in the people that you know.
Yeah.
And your contacts and your playing has to mature, and all these things have to happen for you to start working at a higher level. I don't think you don't sort of dive straight into it, mostly, you know, unless you're in a famous rock band, you know, which is totally different.
How did you get out of it? Like, is there something you did to hustle gigs and sessions?
No, I just got lucky. I got that Pop Idol tour.
How did that come out? How did you get that?
That came out through, I was in the National Youth Jazz Orchestra for about 4 or 5 years. And the guy which is sort of like a bit of a rite of passage here for people at my end of the business, you know, and a guy I knew through that called Ben Castle was the MD. He ended up getting the job as the MD, musical director of this, because they wanted a younger band, but guys who could, you know, also play a bit of jazz and read and all that sort of stuff, you know. And so he got me involved, you know. So it was a stroke of luck just knowing Ben, you know. And through that, I met a guy called Ray Monk, who I don't think he works so much anymore, but he used to do all the TV stuff.
Hmm.
So Ray, I met, and he got me to dep or sub, I think you guys call it, on a TV series called Stars in Their Eyes, which was basically, it's a bit like, you know, people go and impersonate. They go, tonight I'm going to be Axl Rose or whoever
else. Okay.
So it's a TV series, you know. So he got me into that. So that was it, really. You know, I didn't hustle anything. I tell you what the big difference is, I've noticed, is that hustling is a new thing, especially in this country. I don't know what it was like in America, but it's come about through the internet. I think now there's a hustle, but there wasn't. You just got phoned. I don't remember there being that much. I didn't hustle anything in my 20s. Didn't happen. Now I know people in their 20s are Instagram, they're like, hashtag I'm brilliant, hire me, you know, all this shit.
Yeah.
Like, now calm down, mate, why don't you go, you know, like, you've only just started shaving, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah, so it's quite different. So I didn't hustle anything.
No, here is fine. It's always been a hustle here.
Yeah, you know, that's the impression I get.
And
we're all Americanized now. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, some guys have been super clever about it. And other guys, you know, got out of their comfort zone and marketed themselves. And it's all different things, you know. And I was talking to somebody, Rob Harris.
Oh, yeah.
He, you know what he did, man? I thought this was really brilliant. He wanted to get students.
Right.
So what he did, he went to all the here they call them elementary schools. I think you call them primary schools there, maybe like early grades. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Six.
Yeah. Maybe five to 10, five to eight. And he went there into the schools. And he said, "Hey, would you like me to put on some free clinics for the students?"
Really?
About guitars.
Yeah.
How to play guitar. Not- and I said, "Man, that's fucking brilliant." Because then you hand out paper. All these kids, what do they want to do? They want to do that.
Nice thing of him.
I thought that was really, that's great lead generation, man. As a marketing guy, I'm like, well, that's a great idea. So you did this for free, which most lead generation on the front end is. And then you're handing these things out. And then now he's getting phone calls from the parents. So, hey, you know, my son saw you at school. Do you do guitar lessons? And, or I think he actually passed stuff out that said, hey, you know, here's my number if you want guitar lessons or something.
Yeah. Well, especially with Rob's gig being in Jamiroquai. Is Jamiroquai big in the US?
They were huge.
Yeah.
They were huge.
They're big here as well. Yeah. You know, I think they're a great band and Rob's a great guitar player.
Yeah, he sure is.
So I imagine that worked for him because all the parents of the kids would have gone, the guy from Jamiroquai.
This was way before Jamiroquai. This was like when he. That's what I was saying. Like, you know, he was just out of school and he was like, shit, I got to get some, out of his house. I think it was the first time he was living alone, if I remember correctly. And he's like, shit, I got to pay the rent. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is really impressive. Yeah. I mean, I did a bit of teaching in secondary schools. I don't know what you call that, high school maybe.
Yeah.
When I, in that age, you know, like 2 or 3 days a week when I was 21, 22 or something, and I fucking hated it. I can't stand that. I mean, just like kids coming in because they don't want to be in double maths. You know what I mean? And you get the odd one that goes, I really like Metallica. Can you show me how to play Harvester of Sorrow or Battery or something? And I'm like, yeah, man, let's stay here all day and talk about Metallica.
Yeah.
But most of them are just like, yeah, don't know. You know, and it's like, no, I don't want to be here.
Yeah,
it's
shit. Miserable.
Good for Rob.
Yeah. So I think it just depends on the person and on the situation.
Yeah, some people are good at it as well. I mean, every time I try it, it backfires. Every time I try and hustle something, people go, well, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's never worked for me. Yeah, I think that's probably, you know, the universe's way of telling me that I shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
Right.
If something's not going, it's, you know... If it doesn't feel good, then you shouldn't be doing it, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, I even feel bad. You know, I'm not big on Instagram. I don't even have 1,000 followers. It's like 900 and something, but I've just started. I quite enjoy it. And I even feel like a bit of an idiot doing that sometimes. Like, oh, look at me.
You know, dude, let's get you some more followers. It's Adam Gold. What is it? Adam Goldsmith Music? You just told me before. It's The Adam Goldsmith.
Yeah.
The Adam Goldsmith.
They didn't let me have Adam Goldsmith. It's not like The Adam Goldsmith.
Yeah, The Adam Goldsmith. Everybody go follow Adam. Man, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to? I know you got a ton of it. I know you got a bunch of guitars. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what guitars would make out your top three? When I say go-to, not like, oh, I have to use this. You know, the one you like.
My favorite, the ones that I love.
Yeah.
So I do have a different. I was thinking about this the other day. Like two guitars, which I always take to like commercial sessions, which are really useful. But the two guitars which I really love, I've got. They're both from the same year. They're both from 1967. My 335.
There you go. Did that feel odd saying that?
330. You can't say 335. You have to say 335.
You could say 335. I mean, don't get out of your comfort zone, man. So you have your 335.
That, which is just, I mean, they're so different these days, you know, that I've had reissues, Gibson reissues. Whilst they're great guitars, I feel like they're not the same. They're not the same guitars that they were, you know, in the 50s and 60s. I don't know. They just sound and feel different. You know, it's a bit of a subject of mystery, really, isn't it? Because I had one of those Gibson True Historic 58s, and it looked like a friend of mine who's not a professional musician, he's got plenty of money. Which is evidenced by the fact that he owns an original 59 Les Paul.
Burst?
An original 57.
Oh,
yeah. It's his hobby. He's much older than both of us, you know. And so I've been lucky enough to play a few of these old guitars, and they're just, there's something about them, a magic in the wood and the sound and the vibe and everything. And it's so indefinable. Well, obviously, I'm struggling for the right words. So that's, you know.
Is that it right there, the red one on the back?
It's being fixed at the moment. What are you looking for? What are you looking at?
Is that your 335 you're talking about?
That's a Gretsch from the back. You can't see what it is. Yeah. It looks like it might be a 335.
Yeah, I couldn't see if there was a
a
drop on the other end. It's the stress in front of it.
That's a Brian Setzer of Gretsch. I like that as well.
Okay, so 335 from 67. Yeah. What's the other one?
And a 67 Telecaster.
Oh, wow.
Which is that I can. Oh, no, this is not visual, isn't it?
No, but what is it? I'd like to see it.
I'll show you. It's a refinished one, actually. Here it is. It's like a sunburst refin.
That's from 67?
That's from 67. It's really ringy. You can't tell over Skype.
No, that has been. When was that refinished? It's gorgeous.
I don't know. They've done a really nice job, actually.
Yeah.
To be honest, because I like the sound. I'm not a collector, even though I have a lot of them. I'm a player, you know.
Yeah.
I saw a rig, you know, one of those rig rundown things.
Yeah.
And I saw one with a guy called Kenny Greenberg.
Kenny's in Nashville. Yeah, he's a great. He's got a fucking million guitars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I really enjoyed his rig rundown, and he referred to some of his guitars as working man's vintage guitars, which is what I sort of class that as, you know. Like, it's refinished, and I think the one of the knobs has been changed, that the tone knob's something different, you know, some bullshit thing that somebody stuck on there. So it's not a collector's item, but it sounds amazing, and it sounds better than I've got three other Telecasters knocking around, like custom shop ones, and it just sounds better, basically.
You know. Where'd you get those two? The old vintage of 67.
This one, the Telecaster I bought from a shop called Noton Guitars.
Is that like in Denmark Street? What is that?
Denmark Street. Is that, yeah, yeah.
Denmark Street. Yeah, yeah.
On Denmark Street in London. Yeah.
I got to go there sometime. I would never buy a guitar there.
Great. But, yeah. I'll show you around, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to go.
Yeah.
I'm going to come over next time Anne comes to see her.
I'll have a night out.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll tell you all the stories that I can't tell you now. So that's from there. And the 335 is from a shop which I don't think exists anymore in Shoreditch, which is in East London.
Mm.
I think it was called Vintage and Something. I can't remember. Great shop. I think they're called Lucky Fret or something now. It's a different shop, maybe different management. I'm not sure. And they used to be mostly vintage guitars, and now I think they're not. They do, you know, regular, all sorts of guitars now. So, they're both from there. To be honest, my knowledge about them is not on the sort of Joe Bonamassa level of knowledge.
Sure.
Of vintage guitars. So I'd probably only buy them from shops. I wouldn't buy, because I'm looking for a Strat, a 60 Strat at the moment. And I'm only going to buy one from a shop. I'm not going to buy one from like off eBay or something, because I don't know enough about them.
Oh, I know. And then you get it. You don't know. Is it from China?
Yeah.
You know, like there's a ton of bootlegs here that are very good bootlegs from China with the proper serial numbers on them.
Yeah. And it's like that old joke about 59 Les Pauls that, out of 1,500 of them, which were made, only 2,000 remain.
Yeah, right. So, there's tons of them here like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, so I'd only buy them from shops, to be honest, with some comeback.
What's your third? What would be number three on your list after the telly?
Number three, I've actually just got rid of. For the only reason that I didn't use it, and it was worth quite a bit of money, it was a 59 Les Paul Junior.
Oh, I love those, man.
Yeah, it's really great. Well, I traded it in for the telly.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's a bit of money, you know, like, but I just wasn't using it. It was a great guitar.
Yeah.
But I just didn't get used, and I really wanted a telly, and I didn't want to spend any money, so I just chopped it in. I sort of regret it. I don't regret getting the telly, but I sort of regret not just, you know.
Let me ask you something. That's the single pickup, is it a P90 on that?
Yeah, it's a P90, a roaring P90, and I bought a special instead. And the two pickup ones, it's just not quite the same. You know, I think there's something about the one pickup guitars. It was fucking roaring rock and roll beast. You know, it's great. I've got a Marshall, I'm looking at it. You can't see me looking at it. The JTM 45, and I put it through that. And I did an album for a guy called Phil Lanzen a few weeks ago. He was in a band called Uriah Heep.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've just done his solo album.
What was that big hit they had? Back in the day, they had just kind of a slow anthem, great band,
I mean, it was all before I was born, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I used to love, I every time, like not so long ago, I was always the young guy, now I'm like always the older guy, and
it's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really
happens.
I think I feel that there's something wrong now with that. It shouldn't have been. I should still be
You're right. You're like the Joe Rogan of guitar.
I've never listened to Joe's show. A couple of people have said that, and I don't want to do it because I don't.
Really good.
Everybody says that. I'm sure it's wonderful, but I don't want to do it because I don't want to. Because people say that, have said that. I don't want to.
You said that. I'm not the only one to say that.
No, loads of people. And then I don't want to do it because then if I hear something, I don't want to take it. Then they'll say, oh, Joe Rogan says that. So I don't, you know, it's like a jinx. I don't want to do that.
Oh, okay.
It's stupid, I'm sure. But I'm not always. I am stupid at times like everybody else, you know. Oh, so right, yeah.
So there must be something a bit stupid.
You know, it's funny. People call me or they email me. Hey, man, I just listened to four shows. I drove from, you know, Austin, Texas to Chicago. And I'm like, you know, first of all, thank you very much. I'm really glad you enjoyed this show. God bless you. I said, second, I don't know how the fuck you listen to my voice for 8 hours because I would shoot myself if I had to do that. But I don't know. Maybe it's more painful to me. But
I think it must be. Yeah.
Oh, that's the only thing. That's why I hate editing. Not because I don't mind. But it's like, I got to hear myself. And I want to edit me out of the conversation.
Yeah, you have to listen to your own voice. It's weird, isn't it?
Who's your favorite guitar player?
That's a really difficult one to answer. I mean, I've always really liked, I guess Larry Carlton and Steve Lukather have always stuck out, those guys. But there's so many that I like, you know. I mean, for different reasons. I think, you know, if I had to pick one, it would probably be Larry Carlton, you know.
Amongst session players, he's one of the top. Amongst guys that primarily make a living through sessions, he's always.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he does sessions anymore. But,
No, I mean amongst the guys that I've interviewed that make their living. Yeah.
Did you interview Larry as well?
No. What I'm saying is amongst the players I've interviewed, when I asked that question, that guys, because, you know, they modeled a lot of their session work philosophy, you know, or at least got turned on to it, or, you know, somehow Larry was influential in that. So that's a common answer for session guys.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I always loved him. I mean, some like Schofield. I really love Schofield. So, yeah, anywhere which lies on the, you know, the crossover between jazz and rock. Yeah. I don't want to use the fusion word because that sort of has strange connotations of, you know,
the F word.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you know Rob Garland?
Okay, I'm afraid I don't know.
He's an English guy, but he's in the States now, and he's the one who turned me on to that. He goes, I can't use the F word.
The F word.
An English guy, lovely guy, man. You'd love him. He's great.
Oh, right. Yeah. Those two sort of influences. Yeah, all the obvious people. I really like Robin Ford is great as well. I saw him and Larry Carlton together a couple of years ago here. That was great. So many people that I almost don't know where to start. And there's some great sort of new-ish jazz players, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Gilad Hexelman, people like that, sort of New York guys. I think they're both from New York. But to be honest, when I was younger, it was more bands. I was into bands. Like when it came to, you know, rock music, it was bands. You know, I was really into Metallica. I mean, still, I went to see them, you know, like a few months ago. I have to go on my own these days. No one will come with me.
You know? Well, any of your kids boys?
Yeah, he's six. My eldest is a.
Yeah, he'll go. You'll go to concerts with him probably.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to see Slayer in a couple of weeks.
Not with him.
No.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to see Slayer tonight. Okay, Dad.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's going to be into massive burning goat's head. Yeah. Whatever it is they've got, you know. Yeah, sorry.
No, it's good. Anybody you've jammed with, guitar players, that you really enjoy jamming with?
I think, some of the guys that do sessions over here, I'm not sure if they'd be familiar to an American audience. A guy I did a gig with in a bar a few weeks ago called John Paricelli, John is maybe 20 years older than me, or, you know, 15 years older than me, something like that. And he's not on the internet, not on social media, but he's done loads and loads of sessions over here. He's a really great and lovely, gentle man as well. You know, we've done, you know, quite a few sessions together where we've, you know, and I come from the slightly more rock end of things and he comes from the slightly more jazz end of things, and we sort of meet in the middle.
That's nice.
And he's so brilliant. And so I really enjoyed I enjoy doing sessions with him, but we did a gig, like a bar gig, which are always the best gigs where you just play what you want. And we play some Steely Dan, some Scofield and all that sort of stuff. And we just had a great time. So, yeah, I really enjoy playing with him. Also, you mentioned before you'd spoken to Paul Stacey.
Yeah.
Paul's a really great friend of mine. And he, as you know, he was in the Black Crowes for a bit and he produces Noel Gallagher and all that. So me and Paul played a few. We've done some gigs together, you know, we've had a great time. So, yeah, you know, those two guys. I think I might be getting to play with Nile Rodgers in 2 weeks. I'm looking forward to that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I know. Yeah. We're doing a big concert at Wembley for a charity called Children in Need, which is a big thing over here.
Holy shit. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, your wife will know about it. There's a bunch of different pop stars,
There you go.
Yeah.
You're so American.
Yeah.
When my daughter was born, you know, she started growing up. My mother-in-law gets on the phone with her one time. Then she talks to Anne and she goes,
yeah.
Oh my God, she's got that horrible American accent.
American accent is great. That's such a shame.
My wife's like, Mom, she's not going to have an English accent.
Yeah.
Hello. Odd, as strange as that seems. She's in Florida. You know, it was just very funny.
Yeah, that is funny. Actually, my granddad is from America, so I'm sort of cool.
Really?
Yeah, he's from Philadelphia.
Well,
actually, he was born in Russia, and he got an American passport. He came over when he was, like, tiny. I don't really know the story, but I do know what is relatively amusing. But a lot of the, you know, it's well-documented, a lot of the Eastern European Jews and Russian Jews got persecuted.
Yeah. That's what I was – he probably came over and escaped.
Yeah, he did. So he came over. And also the other side of my family came from Russia as well. But what happened was they got sold tickets to go to New York. So I should be American. But actually they, an unscrupulous travel salesman sold them tickets to Liverpool.
Oh my God.
So when they arrived in Liverpool in whatever the fuck, 1901, whatever it was, I don't know.
Oh my God.
They were like, yeah, we're in New York. But actually they were in Liverpool. So
oh
they
my
got,
God. Where's Times Square?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's wild, man. That's really wild. That shit like that used to go on.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Desert Island Discs, top three. Okay. No particular order, just for now. You know, knowing it could change tomorrow. Like, so, what's your knee jerk reaction to that question? Top three records.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I've never thought about this, so I'll think about it now. So, well, I think the first one would probably be a Larry Carlton album, which is a live album that he did called Last Night, NITE. So I really enjoyed that. That for me, that's my favorite bit of his playing when he was, you know, playing the Valley Arts guitar. And it was, you know, I think it was just because it was related to my childhood, I guess, like in the 80s. I tell you what, actually, which I think, and I'm not on my own with this, which I think is just an amazing, ridiculous album, is Megadeth's Rust in Peace.
God, you're a big Megadeth fan, man.
Yeah, I love all those bands. Yeah, yeah. Rust in Peace. I mean, Marty Friedman on that is just unbelievable. Number three. I might have to come back to you on that. I don't know.
Clock is ticking.
That's really difficult. And now I feel under a lot of pressure. Maybe a Paul Simon album. Maybe Graceland or something like that, you know. If I add three, I'd like the different aspects of music. Yeah.
What a songwriter Paul Simon is.
Can I say greatest hits? Huh?
can I say box set, man.
Okay, like a that album, that Larry Carlton album, the Megadeth album, Rust in Peace, and then like a greatest hits of Paul Simon, something like that. I think I'd have everything covered pretty much.
Very cool, man.
Yeah.
What are the most important things you've learned about yourself over your career and just over life, man?
Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. I'd say I'm like gradually learning when to shut the fuck up. I think that I've probably, you know, like maybe in my 30s got a bit carried away and told the occasional person to fuck off who I shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, look back, I probably could have gone, well, maybe you could have handled that a bit better and thought about the future a little bit more, and rather than just like, because I don't really have much of a filter. That's the thing.
Yeah. That's a blessing and a curse, though.
Yeah.
It's a blessing when you're using it in front of the people that are receptive to it. Because they love you for that. Like, you know, hey, I know I'm going to get the real guy. I'm not getting any bullshit and good, bad, or ugly, you know.
Yeah. I think that it makes for good friends, but not always the most successful business decision. Yeah. You know, so I'm getting better at that. I'm trying to apply that a little bit better. So that's quite a big thing.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't, and also if I'm going to have a night out, you know, like if I'm going to have a few beers or whatever, I make sure I, you know, do it away from work these days as well. You know, because there's a period when you're young, especially if you do tours and things like that, when you're sort of, especially being a sideman or a session musician, you can sort of start to think that you're in that little sort of semi rock star bubble, but you're not a rock star. That's the thing. You're actually the same. You're in a service industry.
Yes.
But you get carried away with it. Like, you know, being on airplanes and going straight through customs and all that sort of stuff. So you can get a bit involved in it, and it's not real when you're a sideman.
Yeah.
It's just sort of experience it. So you can get a bit carried away with, you know, nights out and doing whatever you want to do, you know, that kind of stuff. And it doesn't translate to real life very well when you've got to come back and, you know, go to the local store and buy some milk or whatever. And, you know, like you realize that actually you're not a rock star. You may as well be the guy that works in Starbucks because you're in the service industry exactly the same as him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so it sounds like you've gotten some maturity on some of this. Is really what it sounds like.
I think it's only happened recently. Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah. So that's probably the biggest thing, I think. You know, and also, right. I mean, you know, like becoming a dad, that kind of thing. You realize there's more at stake than just your own bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, like you have to go to work. I have to have a job that lasts for the next X amount of years because, you know, kids are expensive.
Yes.
And I don't want them to think I'm a loser. Why is it a busker? You know, not that there's anything wrong with busking.
No. That's good, man. That was really honest. Thank you.
Yeah.
This kind of might maybe a good part two to that. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
That's a good one. Change one thing about myself. I think. Well, this is a bit of a blessing and a curse thing. I think I'd probably care less about what other people thought. But on the other hand, that is also a blessing when it comes to being like a quote unquote session musician, because you are like the people pleasing part of your personality is sort of important musically, because then you can give people what they want.
Yeah.
It makes you work. So, I mean, not that I'm not an over people pleaser at all, you know, but there is a bit of me that's like that. But so I think that I change that socially, but I wouldn't change it in a work environment.
Professionally.
Yeah, because I think it's very useful when it comes to work. Yeah. And especially if you need to play a lot of different styles, you can go, oh, now I can be like this. Love me. You know what I mean? And
then,
you know, so one minute you're playing like Brian Setzer and the next minute you're playing, I don't know, like whoever. You know,
A
school player or something like that, you know. And that's there's an element of people-pleasing in that, I think, which isn't as – I don't think it's brilliant socially, but I think it's good at work. So maybe I'd alter that.
That's an interesting thing that I just started thinking from that, like about how much separation between, you know, personality, is there a shift between personality, your work personality and your real life personality?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an interesting thing.
It is an interesting thing. Yeah. And I think that when you're in your 20s, you don't think about things like that.
Definitely not. Well, I mean, I didn't. I wish I would have.
Yeah. Maybe people do these days. I think they're more exposed as well with social media and everything. I think it's a very different experience being in your 20s now than it was when I was in my 20s, because Facebook didn't exist. You know?
I think a lot of it is maybe like what your parents clue you into, from my perspective.
Right. Yeah. You know?
And I think, like, I spoke with a guy yesterday who was just so together, even as a kid. I was just amazed. I was a guy named Bobby Broom out of Chicago. He's a really good jazz player. And and he grew up in New York City. And I said to him, I said, man, how did you like have the awareness like of all these things. And he goes, my parents, my mom especially, you know, they were just very – offered him a tremendous level of guidance.
Right.
And he happened to be that kind of personality that was receptive to it.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, because I was thinking about myself, like I didn't get any guidance and I'm thinking, would I have been receptive to it? No, but if I had gotten the guidance in the first place, maybe I would have had that person. You know, so you don't know how these things work out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like nature or nurture.
Right, right. And how much is, that's exactly what is nature and nurture. So, and you just don't know because you can't go back and rewind fucking history, of course, you know. So, but that's an interesting point about, how much of your personality can you be and how much can you is a shifting do you have to make?
No, absolutely. So I know it is something you become. I've become much more aware of it in the past couple of years.
Good for you, man.
And ultimately, is that a good thing? I don't know. It's probably good for work. It's good for business, but it's very slightly cynical, I guess, isn't it? Yeah. Because you're exposing certain bits of your personality.
Yeah, but that's when you want. Yeah, but you're in business. They really shouldn't see, you know, like you can't make fart jokes with them, you know?
You can do that. That wasn't the least of my offenses.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying though, right? You know, just like when you're home and your wife asks you a question, you don't have to be politically correct. You can be brutally honest, you know?
Yeah,
and so, I don't think it's, but I do know this, that is probably one of the reasons why I'm not really employable.
No, me neither.
I have to work for myself because I can't like go to meetings and like listen to someone that I perceive may not be as smart as me or as hungry as me or as practical is probably a better, you know, like there's a lot of minutia and bullshit that people create that I don't understand. And I'd be like, fuck it. I'm just not going to do that, man. I'm going to do it this way. And that doesn't work well in a business setting.
I I've got friends of mine who are sort of lawyers and work for banks and stuff. They tell me about what they've had to do at work. And I'm like, why do you let that person, they're successful people, you know? And it's like, so you have to listen to that person tell you this. Why don't you just tell them to fuck off?
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't work like that.
No, you can't do that. So that's why when I started working myself 20 something years ago, I'm like, I'm not employable really. It was like out of necessity.
Yeah. I think it's quite liberating. I like that feeling.
Oh my God, it's liberating. You control your own destiny. I mean, you know, my wife came home last week and one of her friends had a job. He's there like 20 something years and they fired him and he's like, I hope he finds something because he's really hurting. And I'm like, because you have ups and downs periods when you're an entrepreneur. But I'd rather being sort of like responsible for that than waiting for someone else to do it. You know, I feel have faith that somehow by hook or by crook, I'll get something done.
So, well, we've made it this far, haven't we?
So far, man. So good.
It's fine. So that's it, isn't it?
Happiest moment or time in your life?
It's probably kind of now, actually, in a weird sort of way, you know, like kids, I'd say that's it, you know, like, and I sort of feel, I don't think professional musicians ever feel totally secure in their jobs because it's not a secure job, but I feel like I'm as secure as I might be at the moment, you know.
Good for you, man.
I'm not too young and I'm not too old, I guess, you know, like it's sort of.
That bar keeps raising, by the way.
So I've heard.
I assure you, trust me.
Well, there's a picture of me where my firstborn, who's six, when he was born 6 years ago, I've got a full head of black hair.
Wow.
And that's 6 years ago. And now I don't have either of those things.
So hey, better gray than bald, Rob. I mean,
I mean, I don't know. That's going as well. But, whatever.
You're in the club.
Yeah, I like the club. It's a good club.
Yeah, man, it's a great club.
What was the question?
Happiest time in your life.
Oh, happiest. Yeah, now I'm pretty happy at the moment. I tell you what's been a big thing actually. I've cut out booze. Not that I was drinking the occasional binge, but I wasn't drinking every day at all by any. And I don't mean to give people the wrong impression. I didn't cut it out because it was an issue. I just cut it out because I had one really bad hangover, and I just thought, oh fuck this, I'm not doing this anymore. Because in the music business, there's always a bar. There's always something. So you always go, oh, yeah, I've lost wine, whatever. And I thought, I've had enough of this. I feel old and tired and fat. Mm. So So I just stopped. It was a couple of months ago, and I actually feel brilliant.
That's great, man.
Yeah, I'm in a really good mood. And
well, it's a alcohol is a depressant, and like I'm aware of that. So if I'm down, I don't drink very much anyway. But if I'm down, I never ever have it. Which thank God I'm not down very often. But if I am, I never have a drink because I feel it right away. And it's like,
well, that's very restrained of you. Yeah, well, I mean, I used to after sessions because it would be like this adrenaline. You'd be concentrating.
Yes.
If you're in Abbey Road for three sessions or something, you are concentrating all day, and it's you're working at a level where there isn't really anything above that, you know, in terms of sessions, you know,
sure,
movies. So you're like tense, basically. And so afterwards, what the hell do you do? I mean, either you have to get your trainers on and go for a run and be really adult about it, or you can go directly to the bar and neck a glass of wine.
You're going to feel sit down and have a drink. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. But then if you're doing that all the time, it's kind of an up and down to it. So in the morning, it doesn't work after a while. You know, I noticed that it was making me feel a bit anxious the next day. You know, I thought, well, this is just a bit of a silly roller coaster. You know, it wasn't excessive at all. It didn't affect my life really, except I'm just getting older and a bit more unhealthy. But so I just thought I'll give it a miss.
Good for you, man.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have you back on the show next year. You'll have a fitness program ready for musicians.
Yeah, either that or be in rehab.
Either way, we could sell that program. Hey, man, do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
No.
have much time. You got little kids, man.
I used to do a lot of running, like before I had kids. I've done a few marathons and things. I'm shit at them.
That's impressive.
Impressive. I used to enjoy it. I'm pretty slow. I mean, I've never got under 4 hours, but I've done sort of three or four.
So what?
So that was a hobby. But no, not really. It's pretty sad, but I spent all my time looking at guitar. I really love gear. I love looking at guitars.
It's great.
Like old guitars and stuff. So that's kind of my hobby, the vintage guitar end of things. It cross-pollinates with work, but it's kind of a hobby. You know, I love it. You know. And playing with the kids. I mean, you know what it's like when you've got little kids. You really don't have very much time. So, so no, that's a bit sad. Socializing, occasionally I'll go out for dinner. That's nice. You know?
Yeah. That's tough when you got little kids, man. It's just really difficult. Yeah. Your life is really not yours.
This interview is my social life, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm very happy that I'm providing this outlet for you, but I'm sorry that this is, I'm sorry that I'm your outlet. Hey, man, two more questions. Funniest or most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you on stage or in the studio?
Embarrassing studio things. Mistakes. But I remember falling over on stage.
Oh,
When I just started, I guess a lot of people have fallen over on stage.
Yes, tons.
When you're young, it's really – I think I was about 20, and I was subbing on a show it was like a touring show. It was Sheila Ferguson from the 3 Degrees.
Mm.
She in the 3 Degrees. Yeah, I think it was. It's so long ago. Yeah. And they'd introduced the band in the second half, and they had this like moving, like a cart where the rhythm section was. So it was like the drums were behind me and I was next to the bass player, and it would move across the stage. And you had to stand up and sit down at the right time, basically, because it would go like that. It was, you know, it would sort of jerk a bit and it would move. So they'd introduce the band. They'd say, the bass solo, you know, the bass player was drums, like whatever. And then they'd introduce the guitar and they were like, it was supposed to be a big moment because you're supposed to play a big rock solo. And I'd done about three or four shows. So I got into it and I'd forgotten to, you know, I was starting to relax. And I stood up just as the thing started moving.
Oh,
and
my God.
And fucking everything went everywhere. And they went, Adam Goldsmith on guitar like that. And I just fucking went over and knocked all the show.
Is this on TV?
No, it wasn't on TV. It
was
in a theater, you know. Like, I just went over and knocked everything over, all the music, like guitars and stuff. Yeah, just fell over on stage. Yeah, so that was –
That's funny.
Now I would find that funny. But then it was – I mean, it was funny at the time, but it was completely mortifying as well because I was, you know
– Were you horrified back then when that happened?
Was I what, sorry?
Were you like horrified? Because
totally.
That's a British thing too. Like, you guys are a little more reserved, or you have less wiggle room for mistakes with yourself, I think.
Do you think so?
Yeah, it seems like. Like, if that happened here, it would be like, you know, fuck it, that was funny, you know, not a big deal.
To be honest, I think it was more to do with the fact that I was 20 than the fact that I'm... Because if I did it now...
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, I'd probably... I mean, I'd still feel a bit embarrassed, but I'd still be quite... You know, but then you're tense when you're that age. You're trying you don't really know that many people, you know.
Like, yeah, you're trying to make an impression, and it goes back to, like, it's important what other people are perceiving of you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, when you're that age. Yeah, very true, man.
Yeah.
Dude, one last question, and I can't thank you enough. This has been a lot of fun. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been deliberate and intentional, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, I think, to be honest, I'm probably going to end up repeating myself. It's sort of what we just touched on in terms of, you know, being a bit more self-aware and aware of your impact on other people. But I think I've become less selfish. I think there's probably an element of that. And I think that has come as a result of being a parent. Because I remember when I had my first kid, there was a period when I found it difficult to reconcile my old self, where I could just do what the fuck I wanted, and my new self, where I couldn't.
You know,
it was, right, you've got to go home now. You've got to be up at this time in the morning. You have to do that. You have no choice. I remember distinctly there was a moment when I was holding my kid, who at the time, he must have been about a month old or something like that. It was like 4:30 in the morning or some horrible shit. And I'd gotten from a gig and I was like holding the baby, trying to get him to sleep. And I was like, I now have the true understanding of the phrase, no choice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like before that, I think I was like, basically, like, if I don't want to go to work, I don't have to. It only impacts me. If I don't want to go to my doctor's appointment or whatever it is, if I don't want to, you know, go out for dinner, I don't want to tie my shoelaces, you have a choice. And that was the first time I'd gone, wow, I really don't have a choice about it. This is it.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, it's like, that's another level, you know. So it must be that. That's the biggest thing, I'd say, you know. And then
less selfish. That's good.
Yeah, you get it. Well, I'm not saying that I'm not capable of being a selfish dickhead at times. You know, I am. But I'd say that's probably the biggest thing, you know. And then gradually it seeps into your personality, and I think it's probably maybe a better person.
Ultimately. That's great. Yeah, man, being less selfish always makes you a better person.
Yeah. Because I think I probably was not selfish, but self-centered.
Right. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
You know what? You
understand? Yeah, absolutely. Selfish is like someone else's expense. Like self-centered is just, you know, you're not thinking about others as much as you probably should.
Yeah.
Like, I totally get that.
Just think about your ends of things. Rather than, it's like, if it was time for me to get around at the bar, I was always happy to do that. I still am, maybe.
Right.
So that would be,
we'll see,
I guess. But self-centered, it would be like,
yeah, just, you know, like, it's all about you. I totally get it.
Yeah. Like a bit more empathy, I guess.
Which is a good thing, man. It makes you like, I think for me, it made me a better person, happier person. And, you know, I never thought I'd say this 20 years ago, but putting out better, you know, good vibes.
Just absolutely. Nice, and that's kind of what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all what it's all about. Yeah. It makes your life so much more fulfilling, you know?
Yeah.
And it always comes back to you, even if you don't, it doesn't. Like, just by doing that, it's like, you feel good, you know? So.
Yeah, you do feel good because, like, even, and this might be slightly self-centered. you can go, right, I think I'm becoming a better person. I'm quite happy with that, which, you know, it's ultimately
I don't think that's self-centered. No, I think that's smart.
Yeah, probably that. And also, I think there's another, it's weird the way music interacts, like, as you get more relaxed when you're older. I think my playing sounds more relaxed than it used to. Like my sense of where, this is like a practical thing, where the beat is.
Mm.
Because I've relaxed as a person, I think my playing sounds a bit more relaxed. I think it was a bit edgy when I was young. Sometimes I listen to things back that I played in the control room in the studio and go, very slightly pushy and a bit ahead of the beat. I'm not sure I like that. When it felt good when I was playing it, and then you'd listen back and you go, it doesn't sound that groovy. You know, like I think as I've relaxed as a person, actually my playing sounds a bit weird and a bit hippie, like my sense.
No,
of where,
I mean, look at Jeff Beck.
Right.
I mean, that guy's.
In what way?
I mean, he's playing beautifully, and he's just so calm, and you know, he's still gets edgy, but it's like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I understand that totally, man.
He's next level, isn't he? You know that. But I think my sense of where I hear the beat, well, where I play, you know, on the beat and feel and everything probably goes hand in hand as maturing as a person, you know, like, and relaxing and being less anxious possibly, you know, that kind of. So yeah.
Very cool, man. Hey, listen, yeah. I cannot thank you enough for your time. You're awesome. I'm going to tell everybody where to find you and how to support you. It's Adam Goldsmith again. First of all, he's on Instagram at @TheAdamGoldsmith. Follow him on there. He is available for anybody around the world listening for studio tracks at home, out of his home studio. Hit him up on his website. It's adamgoldsmith.co.uk. He's got a really good website, actually. He's a professor. This is fucking scary. He's a professor at Guildhall School of Music and Drama. I feel like I should say that over, because I can't say fucking after I say Guildhall. It sounds like such a like I feel like it's like, you know, I'm saying something about nuns or something. It just sounds so.
And it sounds good. He's a motherfucking professor at the motherfucking Guildhall.
Fucking Guildhall School of Music and Drama, bitches. And he's also available for if you're an intermediate and advanced player and you're looking for lessons, he's available, but also on Skype. But here's the thing, and that's what I thought was really cool. Adam's specialty is helping people learn how to do sessions. You know, he's got some tricks for sight reading and for playing guitar to, you know, certain specific tracks. And so if you're interested in learning how to do sessions or how to be better at sessions or how to become more efficient at playing sessions, I would definitely hit him up. And obviously if you're playing sessions, you're at least an intermediate or probably an advanced player. But if you're just looking for general guidance and you're an intermediate advanced player and you're interested, hit him up too. Check out his playing. He's a really great player and he's not a selfish teacher at all. That's it, man. Any final words of wisdom?
No.
Yeah. Well, dude, I look forward to hanging out when I come over to the UK. And thanks.
That's my final words. You're very welcome. Come around for a cup of tea.
Coffee, man. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks again to Adam Goldsmith for spending time with us. Again, check out his website, adamgoldsmith.co.uk, and support any of his endeavors that he's doing. Make sure you go to the homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so we can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.